content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian Magazine and SmithsonianMagazine.com. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We wish to thank them for their support. We'll start today's program with an article we started last time titled A Way to Istria by Tony Paratet. Journey to the coast of Croatia and encounter ancient mummies, Roman ruins, unique wines, and a slightly lewd parrot. The embrace of morbid truths grew more noticeable as I drove deeper into Istria's mountainous interior. Picturesque medieval towns sprout from almost every crag, but on closer inspection, a Gothic atmosphere hangs over many, tilting the cultural balance from the Mediterranean towards Eastern European. In fact, in the cooler months of autumn, Istria can feel less like the new Tuscany than the new Transylvania. Of course, this also gives the interior its own characters, with the scars of Istria's wars, plagues, and occupations lying closer to the surface. I noticed this first in Vagian, an outpost of the Venetian Empire barely 5 miles from the coast, whose main church tower is the tallest in Istria and was used for centuries by sailors for navigation. While bells tolled mournfully, a guide named Erica Forlani Cardin led me through empty, winding lanes to one of the town's 61 chapels, the one-room church of St. Martin, which was the headquarters of the Inquisition in the 14th century, and still has the word Ecclesia Inquit Istriae, Holy Church Court of the Inquisition for Istria, engraved over the door. After some trials, they buried people alive in the walls, Cardin said. They found the skeletons when they were doing excavations. I'd heard that secreted in a back chamber of the Church of St. Blaise are some 370 Catholic relics, mostly the body parts of 240 different saints, including three intact mummies known to perform miraculous healing. They were smuggled from Venice in 1818 for safekeeping, turning remote Vagian into an unlikely pilgrimage site. The cache is today jealously guarded by the 83-year-old parish priest, Marjan Jelenic, so I went with an interpreter, Dina Zufik, to pay my respects. I was in luck. Father Jelenic was lecturing to 40 high school students, and with a nod, he allowed us to join them in a dark sanctum behind the altar. On one wall, dimly lit cabinets were crowded with dusty glass containers that held artifacts said to be, among other Catholic wonders, a piece of the True Cross, part of the Virgin Mary's veil, and the tongue of St. Mary of Egypt. Most impressive were three desiccated corpses laid out in glass coffins, all still wearing their colorful religious robes. What you see in Vagian can be seen nowhere else on earth, boasted the priest. Even the Vatican doesn't have what we have. Despite his years, Father Jelenic was bursting with energy and spoke with the flair of a Shakespearean actor. Look, look, he cried. Here is the bedsheet of the baby Jesus. Here is soil from beneath the crucifix. Here is a stone from the pillar where he was whipped by the Romans. Here is a part of the crown of thorns. The list went on. There are relics from the 12 apostles, relics from the prophets. Look, look, the finger of St. Anthony. More fingers, so many fingers. The pelvic bones of St. Sebastian. The foot of St. Barbara. The three bodies on display were particularly sacred, Jelenic explained, because of their mysterious state of preservation. This is a miracle right here in Vagian. There is no scientific explanation as to why they are in such good condition. They were never embalmed. In 2009, the corpses were given CT scans in a forensic laboratory. The inner organs were all intact, a miracle. Father Jelenic led us into his office and opened a tome he had written about the trove, called Sanctuarium Adignani, It was as glossy as a high-end museum catalog, with beautifully lit photographs and a price tag of 2,000 euros. Yes, the book costs 2,000 euros, but is worth 10 million, he declared. It's priceless, really. He eagerly flipped through his pages, holding his right hand up in reverence at key images. Relic, relic, relic. Then he paused at a double spread of the mummy of Saint Nicolosa Bursa. While alive, Nicolosa had levitated, and her body could still cure disease. Even her image had spiritual power, Jelinek said, as he dangled a keychain above the page. Look at this energy. You see how the keys move? Just from a photograph. Jelinek is planning to build a lavish vault beneath the church so the relics can be properly displayed and protected. I fear for the relics. A lot of people would like to blow them up. The 30 million euro cost, he hoped, would be covered by book sales and donations. Anyone who gives 100,000 euros will have a bust in the church, he said. In a flash of inspiration, he asked whether the Catholics of the United States could help with funding. I would like this book to reach Joe Biden, so he could give a huge donation to make the vault. Then he cast an eye to the heavens. An angel brought you here. After Vajnin, it came as no surprise to learn that another Istrian village, Kringa, claims to have been the home of the first vampire, or Strigon, a certain Jur Grando Alilovic, who in the 17th century terrorized villagers until he was dug up in the cemetery and decapitated. I was reminded of this when I visited the near-deserted hill town of Barum, where a gaunt vendor selling braids of garlic buds stood at the entrance of a shadowy forest path. The trail led to a small chapel renowned among art historians for its haunting fresco of the Dance of Death, although the sacristan, Sonia Sesten, opens it at irregular hours. A waitress at Barum's only tavern, where villagers were huddled in silence around a fireplace, provided Sesten's cell number. But when I called, Sesten abruptly informed me in Italian that she had to leave soon to make a risotto lunch. When can you come? She barked. Now? Hurry! Sesten awaited me impatiently. Be quick, she instructed, as she unlocked the wooden portal with a giant rusty key. In the sepulchral darkness, I made out the Danse Macabre on the back wall, a series of men and women partnered with grinning skeletons. The masterpiece was signed by the otherwise unknown Vincent from Kostov with the date 1474, but had been plastered over and only rediscovered in 1913. Raised on Ingmar Bergman's film set and the Great Plague of the Middle Ages, the Seventh Seal, I'd expected Death to be a figure draped in black and wielding a scythe. But when I asked, "Where is Death?" Sesten let out a peal of laughter. Death is standing next to each person. Look, there is Death and the Pope, Death and a Cardinal, Death and the King, Death and a peasant. Each person has his own death. Death comes to all classes, and that's good to see too, she said with a laugh, because we all die. She tapped her watch. I have to go home to make risotto with porcini for my husband. As I gave her a lift back into the village, she chortled. My house is next to the cemetery too. I was born in Barum, I got married in Barum, and I will die in Barum. And then with another grim laugh, she disappeared to make her mushroom repast. While I had seen Istria's darker side, and its soulful and occasionally acerbic inhabitants, as somehow at odds with the sunny, light-hearted Mediterranean vibe, the mix now made sense given the trials the peninsula had endured. Its litany of wars, plagues, occupations, and dictators would have crushed the spirits of other, less resilient people. On my way back to Zagreb, I called at the Kozlovic family winery, one of the most successful in Istria and surely the most beautiful. Rows of manicured vines stretched toward a hilltop crowned by a half-ruined medieval tower, all bathed in a light mist at dusk. In Istria, we are peaceful people, mused the winery's current patriarch, Gianfranco Kozlovic, when we met at his tasting room. We have always been caught in the middle of big competitors trying to take control of us. Venetians, Austro-Hungarians, Italians, Yugoslavians, wars and wars and wars. Istrians had emerged fiercely independent, neither entirely Italian nor entirely Croatian. But they've also resisted the lure of the separatist movements that splintered the Balkans in the 1990s. It was a nice idea, he said, of the local independence push that emerged around 2017 and sputtered out, but not a real practical possibility. Instead, for 30 years, Istrians have supported a centrist political party, the Istrian Democratic Assembly, committed to bilingualism and multi-ethnic cooperation. As we raised our glasses, a Malvasia Istrania, I hoped that the moderate spirit of Istrianity would continue to thrive in all its elusive eccentricity. Next, we'll move on to an article from Prologue about national treasure, and this is called Sculpting Dignity by Kovi Biakolo. Pioneering artist Elizabeth Catlett defied trends to honor the daily lives of her subjects. As a young girl, Elizabeth Betty Catlett, born in Washington, D.C., likely in 1915, spent a great deal of time with her grandparents, who had been born into slavery and who took care to teach the children about people's ongoing struggle for basic rights. In the summers, Betty would visit her maternal grandparents in North Carolina, where she saw sharecroppers tilling hard ground and later recalling marveling at their perseverance in the face of extreme poverty. Portraying such people with dignity would become her artistic mission. Betty came of age during the first part of the Great Migration in a well-educated household. Her father, John, who died before she was born, had taught mathematics at Tuskegee University in Alabama before the family moved to the nation's capital. Her mother, Mary, served as a high school attendance officer while maintaining several other jobs to support Betty and her brother and sister. Betty's interest in art bloomed in high school, and she went on to study at Howard University. There she majored in design and was mentored by the artist Louise Mallow Jones, who trained other prominent black artists of the day, including David Driscoll and Sylvia Snowden. Catlett was quickly finding her voice and her purpose. Graduating with honors in 1935, Catlett moved to Durham, North Carolina to teach high school, and then to Iowa City, where she became the first black woman to obtain an MFA from the University of Iowa. She met her first husband, Charles Wilbert White, while studying at the School of Art Institute of Chicago. When the couple moved to New York City in 1942, Catlett taught art at the George Washington Carver School, a night school for working adults in Harlem, where she found major inspiration for her work. Catlett's rapidly maturing style in sculptures and prints were shaped by the stories she'd heard from her grandmothers and sharpened by her experiences in Harlem, where she had seen a quiet daily heroism that she was determined to capture in her work. The art world was moving towards abstraction, yet Catlett in the 1940s was set on diving deeper into social realism to portray black experiences in America, especially the experiences of black women. A crucial opportunity came in 1946 when she won a Rosenwald Fund Fellowship that allowed her to work in Mexico City, which would serve as the artist's home base off and on until her death. It was around this period that Catlett sculpted Head of a Negro Woman, inspired by her time teaching in Harlem, and particularly at a night school where the cultural revival of the Harlem Renaissance could still be felt. Lucia Olbumi Momo, Constance E. Clayton, curatorial fellow at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, says that whether Catlett made the terracotta sculpture in New York or Mexico City remains uncertain. Today, the piece is in the collection of the National Museum of African American History and Culture. The figure's eyes have no pupils. Catlett has replaced them with hollow space, a choice that creates a piercing, haunting presence, while the turn of the chin is almost defiant. It's a startling vision that evokes both modern womanhood and deep African ancestry. The sculptor had taken a wide nose and thick lips, often mocked attributes of black women, and exalted them. Kinshasa Holman Conwell, deputy director of NMAAHC, who knew Catlett, says the generation that raised Catlett worked hard to teach their children that they were somebody, despite the segregation of the era. Conwell says Head of a Negro Woman honors historic figures such as Harriet Tubman, while also reflecting the everyday life of women of African descent in the United States. Very few American artists lifted up black women the way Betty did from the beginning, she says. Momo agrees, noting that Catlett was one of the earliest recognized black women artists whose work focused on uplifting other black women and girls. Catlett's early visits to Mexico brought her into contact with Diego Rivera and Frida Kahlo, and with the Mexican painter Francisco Mora, whom she married in 1947. During her prolific career, Catlett maintained her focus on black womanhood while broadening her repertoire to include Mexico influences. She spent much of her final years in Mexico, teaching at the National School of Plastic Arts in Mexico City, before retiring to the city of Cuernavaca in 1975, where she maintained a studio until she died in 2012 at 96. You can read more about Catlett's work at smithsonianmag.com/dignity. Now we'll move on to smithsonianmag.com, and we'll read an article titled Reimagining Tutankhamun as a Warrior by Bob Breyer. Recent research contradicts the image of the Egyptian boy king as a frail, sickly pharaoh. So Bob Breyer is the author of Tutankhamun and the Tomb That Changed the World. Popular lore suggests that Tutankhamun, the boy king whose immaculate tomb opened a window into the riches of ancient Egypt, was a frail pharaoh. Much of the evidence for this assertion comes from CT scans of his mummy. As archaeologists Zahi Hawass and Sahar Salim wrote in 2016, the CT image also revealed a left club foot deformity. With such a deformity in his left foot, the king would have walked on his ankle or on the side of his foot. Hawass and Salim's assessment came as a surprise to some in the field. After all, Douglas Derry, a skilled anatomist, had examined Tutankhamun's feet in the 1920s and didn't notice anything unusual. Neither did R.G. Harrison, who x-rayed Tutankhamun's mummy in the 1960s. In a 2010 letter to the Journal of the American Medical Association, James Gamble, an orthopedic surgeon at Stanford University, stated that he didn't see a clubfoot in the CT scans. If Tutankhamun's conditions were as severe as the archaeologists argued, he would have likely had asymmetry in the bones of his lower legs and perhaps even the pelvis. But the pharaoh's legs appear to be symmetrical. No signs of asymmetrical wear appear on the dozens of pairs of shoes and sandals buried alongside him. Some supporters of the sickly pharaoh theory pointed to the more than 130 walking sticks found in Tut's tomb. It's worth noting, however, that ancient Egyptians were often depicted with walking sticks as a sign of their authority. If Tutankhamun was, in fact, relatively healthy, it's possible he played another role too, that of a warrior. For evidence of this, look to the boy king's lost monuments. Tutankhamun's first major building, project in Thebes, was the completion of a monument begun by his paternal grandfather, Amenhotep III, who built a 150-foot-long colonnaded hall at Luxor Temple, but died before it was decorated. When Amenhotep's son, Akhenaten, became king, he banished the gods of Egypt and moved to Amarna, leaving the Luxor columns and walls bare for more than a decade. When Tutankhamun succeeded Akhenaten, the boy king returned to Thebes and was advised to complete the decoration of the hall to show he was like his grandfather, not his father, and would give the people back their religion. Tutankhamun decorated the colonnade hall with scenes of the most glorious of Thebes festivals, the Opet Festival. Opet was the ancient name for Karnak, home of the traditional Theban trinity of Amun, the father, Mut, the mother, and Khonsu, their son. At the opening of the festival, statues of the three gods were taken from their shrines in Karnak Temple, placed in divine ships known as barks, and sent 1.5 miles along the Nile to Luxor Temple, where they remained for a week of celebrations. The decorations show marvelous details of the joyous procession from Karnak and Luxor and back at the end of the festival. Tutankhamun is prominently featured in the reliefs on the wall of the colonnade, where he makes offerings to the godly trinity. Unfortunately, he doesn't get credit for his devotions. Instead, his name has been erased and replaced by that of the later pharaoh, Horemheb. For many years, the Egyptian Antiquities Association, now the Ministry of Tourism and Antiquities, has planned to uncover the ancient pathway of sphinxes that led from Karnak to Luxor. While removing later structures built atop the avenue, experts discovered that the foundations of these medieval-era buildings contain inscribed blocks taken from the ancient temples in the area. As the blocks accumulated, Egyptologists from the University of Chicago's Epigraphic Survey of the Oriental Institute, based at Chicago House in Luxor, decided to see if any were from the Tutankhamun colonnade, which was missing the top few feet of its walls. Ultimately, the team found more than 1,500 repurposed blocks. Egyptologist Ray Johnson was among the researchers who studied the temple stones. He noticed that the collection included some 200 additional blocks, including ones that featured Tutankhamun's name, but they did not belong to the Luxor colonnade. Inscriptions indicated they came from the mansion of Nebkuperir at Thebes, a previously unknown mortuary temple started by Tutankhamun and finished by his successor, Ai, as a memorial to the young king after his untimely death. During the New Kingdom, every pharaoh built a mortuary temple where priests made offerings for the soul of their deceased king. Constructed on the west bank of the Nile, not far from the Valley of the Kings, the realm of the dead, these temples are some of Egypt's most famous monuments. On their walls, the pharaohs carved the deeds of which they were most proud. Hatshepsut's temple recorded the expedition she sent to the land of Punt in the south to bring frankincense and myrrh trees back to Egypt. On the walls of the Ramesseum, we can see and read about Ramses the Great's heroic efforts at the Battle of Kadesh. And at the Medinet Habu, we see Ramses III repelling the attack of the Sea People. The mortuary temples are important historical documents, providing information about the reigns of the pharaohs who built them. They are the primary source that enable us to reconstruct the lives of the rulers of ancient Egypt. With only a couple hundred blocks from Tutankhamun's temple, Johnson wondered whether he had enough to reconstruct anything about the boy king's shadowy life. The answer was yes, but only because of the unchanging nature of Egyptian art. Ancient Egyptian artists were often told to copy traditional scenes from previous generations. If you look at the Ramses Museum or Medinet Habu, you'll see the pharaoh alone in his chariot, horse's reins tied around his waist, shooting arrows at the enemy. On one wall, it might be the Nubians, Egypt's enemies to the south. On another, it's the Asiatics and basically the same scene. Because the artists use grids to plan these boilerplate wall scenes, even the proportions are the same. So if you have only a few blocks but you know the rest of the scene should be, you can pretty much fill in what is missing. If you have a block that shows reins tied to a waist, for instance, you know it's a pharaoh's waist, and that there will be a pharaoh above the waist shooting a bow, a chariot beneath the waist, and a pair of horses to the left. And if you have a block with a Nubian with an arrow in him, you know there will be lots of Nubians with arrows in them. The static nature of Egyptian art permits such a reconstruction. Mapping out the scenes on Tutankhamun's mortuary temple took Johnson the better part of 10 years and became his doctoral dissertation. He realized that the blocks depicted two battle scenes, one in which Tutankhamun and a division of charioteers attack a Syrian fort, and one showing the young pharaoh defeating the Nubians. Aside from emphasizing Tutankhamun's skill as a warrior, the reconstruction is important for understanding the development of the standard battle scene. Previously, battle scenes were generally believed to be a development of the 19th dynasty, which followed Tutankhamun's. Johnson's reconstruction shows that Tutankhamun's reign played a significant part in the development. Coming after the Amarna period, when Akhenaten allowed the flourishing of new artistic expression, it's perhaps unsurprising that Tutankhamun's artists retain a bit of this spirit. As Johnson wrote in 2009, the carving style of Tutankhamun's reign is easy to recognize, since it combines Amarna period naturalism with the traditional carving style of his Thutmose predecessors. As a result, Tutankhamun's scenes exhibits a liveliness and energy that sets them apart from temple decoration before and after the late 18th dynasty. Tutankhamun's artists almost certainly contributed to the development of the battle scene genre, but they also introduced some unique details not seen in other works. The traditional battle scenes of later pharaohs include a scene showing the counting of the enemy dead at the end of the battle, an act performed by cutting off the hands of deceased warriors and piling them up for military accountants to record the number. In Tutankhamun's Syrian battle scenes, soldiers are shown with several skewered hands on their spears. Tutankhamun ascended to the throne when he was about 9 years old and only ruled for 10 years. For the first 4 or 5 years of his reign, it's a good bet that he never went into battle. If, however, we discovered a battle scene dated to year 9 or so of his reign, he probably actually participated. The two battle scenes are undated, they are generic, and most likely the boy king stayed at home. Put together, all the recent research on Tutankhamun, from new interpretations of X-rays and CT scans to study of his footwear and mortuary temple, presents quite a different portrait from what is frequently seen in popular media, and even in scientific publications. So was Tutankhamun a warrior? The needle is definitely moving towards yes. This article was cut for time. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening again to the North Carolina Reading Service.